Hello, it's Scott Manley here. With my somewhat belated discussion of NASA's moon base press conference, this was going to be on Tuesday last week. I unfortunately couldn't do it because I had a flight plan already laid out. But I decided that rather than like rushing out a quick story, I would return to my roots and build some of the stuff in Kerbal Space Program to help illustrate what this all looked like. So yes, this is my heavily modded version of it, and this is supposed to be Blue Moon Mark 1. Now, obviously, I started making that stuff, I had a whole lot of fun, I kind of got distracted, and then a giant rocket exploded, and all these plans are sort of like a thrown into question, the exact timing specifically. So anyway, Blue Moon Mark 1 ended up winning two contracts that were announced at this Moonbase press conference. But the press conference basically started out with taking a number of CLPS missions, Commercial Lunar Payload Services missions, that were already paid for and were already planning, and said these are now Moonbase missions. Because Moonbase is much more exciting, right? We have this vision of astronauts in their, like, moon base, hanging out, and you're saying, hey, Bob, or whatever, right? But the moon base that NASA is planning is, well, it's practical, right? It's built around what is possible rather than what scriptwriters imagine. They don't want to have a giant, habitation module right away. What they do want is to have some infrastructure on the ground the moment that the Artemis IV crew land on the surface and get out. They want to have rovers down there. And we'll get to those, but this is, you know, just me flying around a Blue Moon Mark 1, sending it out to the moon to a polar landing. And up until Thursday night, this was expected to be the first mission for NASA's moon base. This was essentially a demo mission of the Blue Moon Mark 1. It had almost no payload. It had some notional basic stuff like, you know, the SCALPS payload, where you have cameras on all the landing legs and it just looks at the plume and how it interacts with the surface of the moon to make sure that they aren't digging a giant hole. You know, because they want to understand this, if you're going to be landing a lot of stuff, you want to make sure that you're not throwing huge amounts of ejecta onto other spacecraft, and you're not digging a hole in the moon that causes your spacecraft to fall over. The other payload it would carry would be some, like, transponder type stuff, laser retro reflectors. This would have been targeting an area known as the Shackleton Connecting Ridge. Essentially, Shackleton is the big crater at the very south pole of the moon. There's another crater nearby called De Gerlach, and there is a sort of ridge that connects the two of those. And so this connecting ridge is about as close as you can get to the South Pole. And this would essentially be landing and putting out a giant banner that says, NASA Moonbase, coming soon.
One of the most unfamiliar things about zero gravity is the way everything just floats around, such as this pen. Yes, this is actually a hover pen, and it will do it on Earth as well, thanks to the power of magnets. Yes, the hover pen is a magnificent piece of design, a piece of functional art that literally stands out on any desk. And when I say it stands, I mean that thanks to those opposing magnets, it'll appear to defy gravity and stand at an angle of 23.5 degrees. In a standard 1G environment. Yes, that's exactly the same angle the Earth's pole makes to the ecliptic. Not only did the designers come up with beautiful lines and the magnetic hover mechanism, they tuned it to this celestially significant angle, which lets you ponder the interconnectedness of the universe, or simply admire it as it spins freely in its mount. These are fantastic gifts, especially for that relative who has the resources to buy everything they need, because nobody thinks they need a magnetically levitating pen until they see this pen hovering in its mount in exactly the same way that lesser pens can't. The Hover Pen Interstellar is available in multiple space-inspired colours. And for people who want a literal rather than a metaphorical link to space, there's the Meteorite Edition, which comes with a small slice of a meteorite in it. Specifically, part of a nickel-iron meteorite formed in a protoplanet's core in the earliest age of the solar system. That planet was shattered and a chunk fell to Earth over Scandinavia about 1 million years ago. It broke apart into many pieces, and those pieces have survived 4 ice ages before being unearthed by meteorite hunters. Point is, as a space rock nerd, I can confirm it is legit. Novium have other designs, such as the Hover Pen Future, which hovers at a steeper angle and which can switch between being a roller ball and a fountain pen if you want those space age aesthetics with old school calligraphy. With Father's Day around the corner, I bet a bunch of you are thinking the HoverPen might be the perfect gift. So head over to HoverPen's website and use my discount code, SCOTT, for 15% off all HoverPens for the 72 hours after this video release, and 10% after that. Free shipping is available to most countries, including North America, UK, Europe, and Australia. And now, back to the video.
See, Moonbase 2, not to be confused with Moonbase Phase 2, which is the block of missions, Moonbase 2 is essentially taking the Astrobotic Griffin lander mission, which was originally supposed to carry Viper. Viper, of course, ended up getting cancelled and reincarnated, and it's going to fly on a Blue Moon Mark 1 sometime. That left the Griffin with a big, you know, payload-sized hole in its manifesto, and they ended up getting a contract to carry Astrolab's Flip Rover, which is essentially a test platform for their larger Flex Rover. Like, I mean, I think Flip is an anagram of Flex Lunar Innovation Platform, and Flex is an anagram for Flexible Logistics Exploration. So that's an anagram inside an anagram. I saw this at, Astro Awards in Austin. And in many ways, Flip is supposed to be a tech demonstrator for stuff which will be in Flex. And, well, Astrolab have the contract to also land one of the first rovers on the moon, the Lunar Transportation Vehicles, which will be used by astronauts. And so Moonbase 3, that is taking Intuitive Mission's next flight, carrying the PRISM payloads, which are supposed to look at surface properties of something called lunar swirls. These are regions on the lunar surface where the regolith looks brighter, and it's believed that's because solar wind is not impinging on the surface and modifying its chemistry. So that might be because of things like electromagnetic fields, or just magnetic fields, I guess, in the regolith. And I guess it's a good place to put a lander. However, despite being branded as Moonbase, which is supposed to be at the South Pole, this is actually landing pretty much near the equator. However, its link to the Moonbase is that it is carrying a rover built by Lunar Outpost. And Lunar Outpost have also been contracted to build a lunar transportation vehicle for astronauts. So anyway, I kind of find it amusing that the Moonbase missions are named in order of size, with Blue Moon Mark 1 towering above anything that humans have landed on the moon, or at least soft landed on the moon. And Astrobotic's Griffin is carrying a bit more payload than Intuitive Machines Trinity. But all of these missions were supposed to launch this year, and I'm presuming that Griffin and Trinity are both going to remain on schedule for now, and yeah, Blue Moon Mark 1, we don't know when that's going to happen. Now, there are a number of other CLIPS missions which have not been rebranded to Moonbase just yet. For example, Firefly's Blue Ghost Mission 2 going to the far side of the moon. We have Intuitive Machines Mission number 4. And then, interestingly, Blue Moon Pathfinder Mission 2, which is going to carry the Viper rover to investigate polar sites, which seems like a Moonbase mission, if you ask me, is currently still a CLIPS mission. So yeah, that first landing was supposed to be the Blue Moon Mark 1 without any payload. The second one is supposed to carry a rover of some sort, and I've made this a human, well, Kerbal-driven rover. As you may have noticed, the Blue Moon Mark 1 is rather tall. They actually have a scale model of this sitting in their lobby at their factory in Florida. And I got to visit, and it is indeed absolutely massive. And one of the reasons it's so big is because it is a lander that is built around using hydrogen as a propellant. And that really makes a difference, because mass is everything in getting to the moon. Now, of course, this was designed to be launched on a New Glenn launch vehicle, and after Thursday night, we're not sure whether it will be the first mission. There are a couple of other Moonbase missions which have been rebranded, and those are likely to get there first. So Moonbase 1 may actually be after Moonbase 3 at this rate. So a while back, Blue Origin posted some pictures of the tanks and the structure prior to assembly. So you see that large hydrogen tank, the structure in the middle, and there are 4 liquid oxygen tanks around the outside that are set around the bottom. So you can see how the basic structure of this lander is made up. Propulsion is supplied by a BE-7 engine, which is their like small expander cycle engine. Now, some other details to see is that obviously we get solar panels and a platform sitting on the top. There are a couple of large cylinders, like pressure tanks, on the top section. So these are paired on opposite sides. Two of them are for RCS propellant, so that would be like presumably liquid monopropellant. And the other one, I think, is for pressurant, you know, helium gas to pressurize the RCS system. And also visible on one side, although ideally it's the side that is away from the sun and therefore hard to see, is a radiator system which will be used for cooling. So I think because hydrogen has such a low boiling point, they need to actively keep it cool during its journey to the moon. So now, because the lander is so tall, they need a way to get that hardware, the payload, on top down to the surface of the moon. So they have like a davit and crane system on top. Funny thing in Kerbal Space Program, it's really easy to build rockets and stuff. It's really hard to actually build things like cranes that have mechanical parts with hinges that move around. So this is what I ended up doing, using the robotics parts that were available in the Breaking Ground. I forget. Yeah, I think it's Breaking Ground was the expansion. To be clear, this is by no means a stock Kerbal build. There's a lot of bits and pieces here that have come from different mods, and I honestly don't remember which ones, but I do have all the best graphics mods to make the lunar surface look as magnificent, as desolate as it is supposed to. But yeah, we don't actually have the crane mod, so I just have to have a very long piston that extends outwards, bringing the rover down towards the surface so that it can then be jettisoned. So as I said, there were two rover contracts which were announced as part of the Moonbase program. The first was Astrolab's lunar rover vehicle, and the second one was Lunar Outpost's Pegasus lunar rover. And with terribly unfortunate timing, the lander for these was both supposed to be Blue Origin's Blue Moon Mark 1. They have to get these on the surface before the astronauts get there, because the astronauts are supposed to be able to use them to drive around. However, these rovers will also work remotely, autonomously. They can recharge and they can survive the night. At least that's the plan. So they will be able to continue roving even when there's no astronauts up there to mind them and tend them. I guess if something breaks, the astronauts might be able to fix them, which is kind of an interesting new capability. So again, this is very much a moon-based mission. It is the kind of infrastructure you want at a base, even if it isn't actually like a habitation module, a garden hut that the astronauts could spend time in. Actually, thinking about it, a lightweight moon garage might actually make a lot of sense. Essentially like a space tent that opens up its doors and covers the rovers during the night to keep them warm. You know, it's just be like a Mylar or whatever that reflects the light, the heat back in, keeps them a little bit warmer, makes surviving the night a bit easier. Yeah, I wonder when we'll see your first lunar garage. Okay, Scott, you're getting distracted. So the other rover was the Lunar Outpost Pegasus rover, which is a smaller version of their Eagle rover. In fact, both of these lunar terrain transportation vehicles, which are being specced for these early missions, are lighter weight versions of larger ones, which we've seen the companies developing. And again, they've decided, you know, NASA really wants to go with dissimilar redundancy so that they have, you know, different options if something fails. Both of these are going to have rover hardware flying on previous missions so that they can verify and demonstrate their capabilities. Now, there were other contenders that had submitted rover designs or proposals, one of which was Intuitive Machines' Moon Racer. That didn't make it. In fact, if I go to the webpage announcing it, it says the content is no longer available. So the third contract announced, and perhaps the most interesting on a technical and legal standing point, is the Moonfall drones. And I'll talk about, you know, the legal side of things, which makes this interesting. So Moonfall is sort of a lunar version of Skyfall. The idea is small, very simple landers that are able to fly around, and not only after landing, they're able to take off and hop across the surface going elsewhere. And while they're doing this, they can do high-resolution surveying off the surface. So these are supposed to use a lot of simple commodity off-the-shelf parts. The idea is that because you're building multiple ones, it'll be cheaper to build lots of them, so they might have multiple Moonfall missions. They might send multiple, you know, they might keep on sending these things out to the moon. Now, the Skyfall drones, they can recharge with solar power. However, on the moon, you can't do that. You can recharge with solar power, but you need propellant, and the propellant doesn't come from the sun. I built a Kerbal version, by the way, except that somewhere along the lines, I heard them say three or four landers, and I decided to go with three, and now all the images that they've been published show four, so bear with me. Now, the company that got the contract for landing this is Firefly, and they're not going to use their Blue Ghost lander architecture. They're going to use their Elytra bus, their Elytra Dark, so that is able to carry other payloads. They don't actually have to land this on the surface. The Elytra spacecraft will slow the drones down, the payloads down, and then as they get slow over the surface at a certain altitude, they're going to let those eject, and those will fly off and make their own landings in different locations. Presumably the bus then crashes into the ground somewhere, presumably far enough away from the base. I actually wanted to try to land this at least somewhere close to the base just to, you know, make it look cool. Now, the only problem with doing this in Kerbal Space Program is that all four of those Moonfall spacecraft are supposed to come off and autonomously land on the surface, and the autonomous part is kind of lacking here. I wasn't going to write a bunch of flight software for these things, so I'm just going to fly one of them, and then hopefully the other ones will end up landing on the surface at a low enough speed that they can survive. So in terms of size, these are going to be significantly larger and heavier than the Ingenuity helicopter that was flown to Mars, even although in principle they're supposed to share some sort of DNA or whatever in their concept. As I said, they have to carry all their propellant on board. They are something about 7 feet across, apparently, based on estimates. They probably weigh several hundred kilograms, and a lot of that will be propellant that they need to carry. In the presentation, they talked about them being able to cover about 30 kilometers, and they also referenced a hop, which would be 5 kilometers at about 800 meters of altitude. And if you do some math on that, it works out to put between 250 to 300 meters per second of delta V you need to do that. Maybe more, maybe less. It all depends on the amount of thrust and everything that you've got available to you. But that would imply then that they have about 1.8 kilometers per second of delta V, which is pretty close to what it takes to actually land on the moon from orbit. Now, I said that they were interesting from a legal standpoint, and that is because during the press conference, they talked about setting up a perimeter to the moon base. And of course, immediately people start thinking about keep out zones and claiming territory, which is, of course, not allowed under the 1967 Outer Space Treaty. Now, from a practical point of view, you might want to set up a perimeter because you can have navigation hardware on these things. So after they've done their missions, after they've expended all their propellant, they can sit there, they can act as transponders. They can provide ground-based augmentation of satellite navigation systems to enable precision landings, which is something that you probably want to be doing if you're having lots of hardware close by and want things to hit very carefully targeted landing sites which have been prepared. These type of self-deploying moonfall drones could also carry communications hardware. They could be the first cell phone towers on the moon. But the Outer Space Treaty does sort of support the notion of safety zones around hardware on the surface. Essentially, areas where nations would like people to keep out to, allow support for things like protecting the hardware from being damaged or protecting scientific operations and whatnot. And I believe there's definitely the notion of safety zones where you want to mark the fact that you have a giant nuclear reactor emitting neutron radiation and that people probably shouldn't go near it. All this stuff is very academic until suddenly it isn't. I mean, you might have noticed that some of the first questions during the Q&A section came from Russian journalists, who, of course, Russia has claimed to former Soviet hardware on the moon, well, with the exception of the pieces that they sold off. For example, they sold a rover to Richard Garriott, so I guess Richard Garriott could... So if lunar claims based on hardware were ever recognized, there would be a corner of the moon named Britannia. But of course, Russia aren't putting anything on the moon anytime soon. The US is the one that has all the big plans for their moon base near the South Pole. And yet China is actually planning on landing Chang'e 7, very close to Shackleton Crater, starting possibly in August. So yeah, this is like a map of the South Pole of the moon, and Shackleton Crater is obviously in the middle, the Earth is to the top. On the left, that is the Gerlach Connecting Ridge, where we were talking about Blue Moon Mark 1 landing. And on the right, That circle is where Chang'e 7 is supposed to be landing. And during that golden moment of optimism that was NASA's Moonbase conference, these landings were supposed to take place months apart. Now, as a result of what is euphemistically known as the anomaly, Blue Moon Mark 1 won't get there until a year later. It remains to be seen how much work Blue Origin is going to have to put in to get back to flight status, and what NASA might do in the intervening time. As we speak, I believe the Griffin lander is planned to launch later this year, and it will get near the South Pole on Mons Mouton, but maybe there will be changes to that plan. I'm Scott Manley. Fly safe.